You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
Let's begin talking about ammonia synthesis in a ball mill. What is a ball mill and why is ammonia synthesis so important?
Okay, right. So here's a fact that I always tell my first year students, and it really should blow their minds, but I get the occasional gasp, but not really. So the synthesis of ammonia on planet Earth consumes annually about 1-2% of all of the energy generated on Earth every year. Okay, so I'm waiting for the wow.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, so you should be. Okay, so this is an extraordinarily important chemical reaction, possibly one of the most important industrial chemical reactions on the planet. Why do we need all that ammonia? We need it for fertilizer, essentially. And obviously, plants need nitrogen-containing molecules. Plants can fix the nitrogen in the air. And so they can basically take nitrogen out of the air and they can form nitrogen-containing molecules out of that. Humanity is not so clever at being able to do that, and certainly not at under conditions of room temperature and just normal atmospheric pressure, okay? We really can't do that yet. So in order to make ammonia, what humans do is they take a mixture of nitrogen and hydrogen at very, very high pressures. So the pressure's around about 200 times the atmospheric pressure. And that's the equivalent of being down 2,000 meters under the sea. So that's a big pressure, okay? And around about 500 degrees Celsius as well. And under those conditions, in the presence of a catalyst, you can get ammonia formation. So now you can understand why it's such an energy intensive process, the high pressures and the high temperatures required. So any improvement to this process, which has been known since the early 1900s, it was a guy by the name of Fritz Haber who developed this. And because of his development, this basically kept Germany in World War I when they couldn't get their shipments of nitrates that they used to generate gunpowder. And so Haber sort of came to their rescue in that respect. And really strangely, he got awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1918, the last year of World War I, for this. But I digress just a little, as I occasionally do. So what we need is a more efficient process to be able to do this. So there's some workers in Germany this week have published a paper in Nature, that rather good journal, basically saying that they can now make ammonia, small amounts of ammonia, granted, using a thing called mechanochemistry in a ball mill. There's a new word for possibly everybody this morning. So ordinarily, when we do chemical reactions, what we do is that we take two reactants and we dissolve them in a solvent, some sort of liquid, and we mix them together and they react. And they react because in the solvent, the molecules of the reactants can bump together, can collide together, and in doing so react, because that's what they have to do. In order to get a chemical reaction, you're going to have two things colliding, okay? And so if we're in the gas phase, that's okay, because gas phase molecules are moving very fast. They will collide quite happily. If they're in solution, they'll also do the same. If they're in the solid state, nah, not really, okay? So people have thought for a long time that, yeah, you need to dissolve things up in order to get them to react. But now there's a new form of chemistry called mechanochemistry, where you basically can take solids and grind them up in a ball mill together. Okay, so a ball mill is just a big rotating hollow cylinder. It's got some steel balls in it. They clack, 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 clack around. You've got your solid in there as well, and that grinds up the solids. The particles of the solids intimately mix and they react. Now, what these guys have done is that they have found a way of taking nitrogen and hydrogen in this ball mill. They put it in there in the presence of an iron catalyst with some cesium. So this is a rather rare metallic species called cesium. And what they found is that they can make, at room temperature and pressure, they can make about 0.5% yield of ammonia, okay, which doesn't sound very impressive at all. The fact that they can do it at room temperature and normal pressure is just amazing. And this is going to be big, I think. This could well change everything. So they've just published this. Sorry, it wasn't Nature, it was Angewandte Chemie, which is the best chemistry journal out there. And most definitely, we've got to keep an eye on this, because, you know, if this does work, if it does scale up, if they can get the yields better, then this is going to save a hell of a lot of energy.
Yeah, that sounds very exciting. And I really like the word cesium. I think that's cool. Let's wind back the clock 1,000 years now and talk about Vikings in North America. Tell us what's been discovered.
Yeah, well, this and exactly 1,000 years as well, which is quite cool. So as every US school kid knows, Columbus discovered America in 1492. Except obviously he didn't, because obviously there were Native Americans there prior to that, who had come, I think, from Russia across the Bering Strait, I think, originally. But there had been Europeans who had settled North America prior to Columbus, and they were Vikings. And so this has just been studied in a paper in, this time, Nature, this week. And so some scientists in Canada and the Netherlands and Germany have found the definite date when these Vikings came and set up a particular settlement in Newfoundland, the settlement called L'Anse au Meadow.
That might take my new favorite word, actually, for this episode.
So they have dated this exactly to the year 1021.
Wow.
Exactly 1,000 years ago. So this settlement, this Viking settlement, now there are wooden implements there, and what people have tried to do over the many, many years since this had been excavated is to try and figure out an exact date for when this was settled. And the best that people have been able to do is roughly sort of plus or minus 150 years or so, which, you know, is quite a big time in terms of something that's only about 1,000 years old. And the way that they've done this in the past is using radiocarbon dating, carbon-14 dating, which is the way that basically all things that were once living are dated. Now, back in the days, the carbon-14 dating was not as precise as it is now. And now we've got these incredibly, incredibly precise techniques when you can almost look at single atoms of carbon-14. Quite remarkable stuff. So what they've done is that they have taken these wooden objects and they're basically counting the rings on them. As you know, trees, they add an extra ring every year of growth, and you count those rings and you get some idea of how old the tree is. Now, the big trick here is that it was known that in the year 993, there was some big solar event, and that had led to a big spike in the production of carbon-14 in the atmosphere. Now, the way that radiocarbon dating works is that all living things, you and I included, incorporate radioactive carbon from the atmosphere. And when we die, all that radioactive carbon starts to decay because we're not ingesting it anymore. And so the levels in our bodies or in trees or whatever was once living decay away. So these wooden implements could now be dated with certainty, because what they could then do is that they could correlate a particular ring on these old implements, a wooden ring, with the year 993. They could count essentially the carbon-14 in individual rings. And so they knew, wow, indeed. And so they now know for certain which ring corresponds to the year 993. And if you know that, then it's just a simple matter of counting the rings up until the tree was felled. And they worked out that obviously there were another 28 rings after the 993, the year 993 ring. And that basically puts the settlement at a year of 1021 CE, which, again, exactly 1,000 years ago. So there's some pleasing symmetry to the fact that that has happened this year. And, you know, that'll now go down in the history books as the first absolutely known dated colonization, I guess, of North America.
Yeah, incredible discovery. Sort of meant to be that accuracy. That's amazing.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful stuff.
Let's finally bring the clock a little closer to our present day and tell me what happened in the world of nylon today in 1938.
Indeed. Again, another one of these sort of anniversary things, October the 27th, 1938, a big announcement by the American chemical company DuPont, and they announced manufacture, I guess, of nylon, or at least the synthesis of nylon. It didn't go into production for another couple of years, But nylon was essentially the first artificial fiber and seems, I guess, incomprehensible to us these days to think of having to rely on nature for everything you wear, or, you know, all fabrics, clothes, all of that sort of stuff came from nature, be it cotton or wool, et cetera, et cetera. So DuPont made an enormous advance with this new artificial fiber, and it revolutionized, obviously, the fiber industry. It revolutionized chemistry. And essentially now we can't live without such things. Now, the interesting part of the story here, well, one of the interesting parts of the story, obviously, is the guy who discovered this. He was a guy by the name of Wallace Carruthers, and he was an employee at DuPont. He was a fabulous young scientist who'd come up through the ranks. He had an academic position at Harvard at a very, very early age, and he got poached essentially by DuPont, and he did fabulous work. And basically what he discovered was polymers, polymer chemistry. Hopefully everyone's heard of polymers, and polymers are just very, 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 very big molecules. An example of a polymer would be a protein, for example. Proteins are molecules that are made up of little small repeating units, and we call those units amino acids. Or DNA is a polymer, and their repeating units there are called nucleic acids. And Carruthers was the first person to figure out that polymers are made up of these small repeating units that are called monomers, mono being one, poly being many. And he basically started off polymer chemistry. And polymer chemistry now is an extraordinarily important area of chemistry. Massive amounts of polymers are produced in plastics, in fabrics, you know, all sorts of stuff. So it's a real lifeblood of planet Earth now. And the really sad story about Carruthers was that, unfortunately, he did not live to see his creation put into practice, because sadly, he was a lifelong depressive. Apparently he used to carry a vial of cyanide around with him, which is really, really tragic. It's just a ridiculously sad story. And in early 1937, he ended up taking his own life, fully a year and a half or so before the announcement of nylon. And even more tragically, about 6 months prior to the birth of his only child. So he made an extraordinary advance in science. He didn't live to see it. Had he lived, he would have undoubtedly won a Nobel Prize for chemistry. The discovery was that important. So I guess that's what happened on this day in 1938. And a really, really sad bynote to that, I guess. So
yeah.
Sorry to end on a downer. But
it's okay.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.